If Iraq fails to fully comply, the United States and other nations will disarm Saddam Hussein.
This is a country that's been bombed by both Democrats and Republicans, so no one here is under any illusion that Democrats are necessarily better than the Republicans.
Iraq can essentially get out of being in breach by going along with a very rigorous, very intrusive inspection regime.
India will be among the number one victims of any war will be waged on Iraq.
I'm personally filled with trepidation that the United States government will use the Kurds again, not for their own ends, but for the end that the United States government has in mind.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, November 8th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The UN Security Council unanimously approved a tough new Iraq resolution today aimed at forcing Saddam Hussein to disarm or face serious consequences that would almost certainly mean war. President Bush threatened Saddam Hussein with the severest consequences if he fails to disarm. Speaking from the White House Rose Garden, Bush said, "The outcome of the current crisis is already determined. The full disarmament of weapons of mass destruction will occur. The only question," says Bush, "is for the Iraqi regime to decide how."
The world has now come together to say that the outlaw regime in Iraq will not be permitted to build or possess chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. That is the judgment of the United States Congress. That is the judgment of the United Nations Security Council. Now the world must insist that that judgment be enforced. The regime must allow immediate and unrestricted access to every site, every document, and every person identified by inspectors. With the passage of this resolution, the world must not lapse into unproductive debates over whether specific instances of Iraqi noncompliance are serious. Any Iraqi noncompliance is serious. America will be making only one determination: is Iraq meeting the terms of the Security Council resolution or not? If Iraq fails to fully comply, the United States and other nations will disarm Saddam Hussein. All patriotic Iraqis should embrace this resolution as an opportunity for Iraq to avoid war and end its isolation. The time has come for the Iraqi people to escape oppression, find freedom, and live in hope. The American people are grateful to the Security Council for passing this historic resolution. The members of the Council acted with courage and took a principled stand. The United Nations has shown the kind of international leadership promised by its charter and required by our times. The outcome of the current crisis is already determined. The full disarmament of weapons of mass destruction by Iraq will occur. The only question for the Iraqi regime is to decide how.
The resolution was finally passed after 8 weeks of debate in the Security Council. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy on the September 11th Crisis. She's at the U.N. where she's been following today's developments. Phyllis, the long-awaited resolution has been passed. What's in the final language?
The resolution identifies Iraq as being in what is known as material breach of earlier resolutions. It sets in motion a process by which Iraq can essentially get out of being in breach by going along with a very rigorous, very intrusive inspection regime. The inspection regime is a lot tougher than the last inspection regime, and there's questions about, even with the best of intentions, whether Iraq can actually comply. But the inspection regime is now going into effect. There's a very tight timeline. The director of UNMOVIC, the UN Arms Inspection Agency, has said he's not even sure that Iraq can, within 30 days, make the kind of detailed listing of all of its production facilities that is required. But that's only one of many potential pitfalls. The key aspects of the resolution that were debated so fiercely in the 8 weeks that led to the last-minute overnight changes, Thursday night to Friday, when the French and the Russians said they simply were not yet satisfied, had to do with how the second stage of the resolution would be implemented. The second stage of the resolution is a call towards the end for the Security Council to reconvene if Iraq is found to be in violation of any of the requirements. What was left ambiguous was who can say that Iraq is in violation. And the final overnight negotiations clarified that in a rather significant way that says that only the directors of the two arms agencies, the UNMOVIC agency and the International Atomic Energy Agency that's responsible for the nuclear brief in Iraq, only they can make the judgment of an Iraqi violation that would trigger a council meeting. So if the U.S. wants to tell the council, well, we think that Iraq is violating X, Y, or Z, they can certainly say that, but it doesn't have the same effect. It doesn't have the effect of triggering the meeting to assess whether there's a violation and what the response should be.
So are you confident that this resolution, as it's written now, prevents the U.S. from actually reading in between the lines that Iraq has materially breached this new resolution and it can therefore go ahead and wage an attack without coming back to the Security Council?
Absolutely not. That was the good side of what the final negotiations focused on. The weakness that remained through the 8 weeks of negotiations and what remains in the final language today is that nowhere does the resolution state explicitly that only the Security Council is authorized to judge, one, whether Iraq is in compliance or not, and two, if there's a violation, what to do about it. It doesn't say the U.S. or any other country is allowed to go and make its own decisions, but neither does it specifically prohibit that. And it's that ambiguity that the U.S. also was counting on when we heard from Colin Powell and President Bush and pretty much everybody else in the administration all using the same language that, quote, the U.S. is not handcuffed by this resolution. Mm.
So in other words, it's pretty porous U.N. speak, so to speak, language that will allow either side to interpret this the way they want to.
Exactly. And what I'm afraid we may see is an effort by the U.S. to claim that any military action it engages in is being done in the name of this resolution. The French and the Russians and everybody else will say, we don't think so, and they will politely agree to disagree. There is, of course, a history of this. Back in 1998, we had a very similar scenario where on the verge of a U.S. war in Iraq, the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan went to Baghdad, was able to negotiate a stand down, came back to the council passed a resolution endorsing it, and at the end of the day, every council ambassador came out one by one saying, this does not give any country the right to move unilaterally. The U.S. ambassador, Bill Richardson at the time, came out last, looked around at the assembled journalists and said, we think it does.
And what happened?
6 months later, we had Desert Fox, when the U.S. and
Desert
the
Fox?
British... Desert Fox, where mm-hmm. the U.S. and the British unilaterally engaged in a massive 4-day bombing bombardment of Iraq. So I think that there's every reason to be wary. We should recognize that this resolution does provide a tool for governments around the world and for the anti-war movement in the United States to hold the U.S. accountable. There is nothing in this resolution that allows the U.S. to go to war. We can be very clear in demanding that our government abide by what this resolution says, and not that it take it as very limited. We have to uphold the Charter of the United Nations, which says very explicitly that only the Security Council has the right to make the decisions regarding international peace and security. The U.S. simply does not have that right.
Well, even though it sounds like there's enough loopholes there for the U.S. to wiggle through, the Bush administration to wiggle through if it wants to.
They will claim it, but you're right, Verna, I think if they want to go to war, they will go to war. This resolution will not stop them. But the popular opposition can stop them. The opposition of the Joint Chiefs of Staff can stop them. The opposition globally of the world governments can stop them. And this resolution is a tool for all of those.
Well, why did France and Russia agree to this porous language?
At the end of the day, I think they felt they had no choice. They are very eager to preserve their access to Iraqi oil fields. The existing oil contracts that they've signed would be in serious jeopardy if the U.S. goes to war, imposes a new regime in Iraq, and views France and Russia as having been on the wrong side of this vote. Russia, beyond the oil arrangements, is also very concerned that its $8 billion debt from Iraq could be ruled null and void, and the new government could simply announce, we have no intention of taking on the debts of our predecessor. Russia would be out $8 billion. So there's a great deal of economic interest riding on this and riding on being on the right side of what they perceive is most likely to be the winning side.
So would it be fair to say, after 8 weeks, at the end of the day, France and Russia caved?
I think everybody caved some. The consequences of France and Russia caving are in many ways more severe than how the U.S. caved. The U.S. did not want to give in on the issue of being able to come back to the council themselves. That was a significant concession for them. But certainly the acceptance at the end of the day by France and Russia is the far more fundamental acceptance of U.S. power.
Mm-hmm. And so what, very briefly, Phyllis, can you tell us about this inspection regime that is going to be a lot tougher than the previous inspection regime?
Under the new inspection regime, the inspectors will have the right to declare what they call frozen zones, where they will be no-fly and no-drive zones. They will have the right to take Iraqi scientists out of the country to be interviewed outside the country and take their families with them, thus turning the arms inspectors into essentially asylum officers. There is a host of new provisions involving the role of UN security guards. There is an abandonment of the earlier arrangements for inspection of the so-called presidential sites. Those will no longer be treated any differently than any other site in Iraq. So in general, they are much more rigorous demands on the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Iraqis start out already in material breach. And what do they have to do to get out of that status?
To get out of that status, they have to cooperate fully with every part of the resolution, allow the inspectors to go wherever they want, whenever they want, for as long as they want. And they have to not challenge any country that is implementing a UN resolution. That part of the resolution was specifically designed to essentially legitimize the so far unilateral U.S.-British no-fly zones in the north and the south. What it means is that if Iraq attempts to shoot down an American plane that is bombing their territory, for instance, and we know that those bombs killed 144 people in 1999 alone, if Iraq tries to shoot down one of those planes, whether or not it succeeds, that would stand as an additional breach. So it has gone further than ever before to legitimize something that the U.S. initially imposed on its own and had never been endorsed by the United Nations before.
Mm. And what of the palaces? There was so much discussion and debate as to whether or not the palaces would have to be subject to inspections.
As of now, the palaces are to be treated no differently than any other part of Iraq. There is no longer a special arrangement as once existed to inspect the palaces with smaller numbers and with diplomatic accompaniment. From now on, the palaces will be treated as any other site.
And we can assume that President Saddam Hussein is going to accept this agreement, having very little choice, hold his nose and sign it?
I think it's likely. I don't think we can assume anything. Iraq clearly sees this as a U.S. pretext for war. The fact that the negotiations went on in the way they did would give some credence to that fear. On the other hand, it's true Iraq has very little choice and the government has very few friends. So it's quite likely that they may see that accepting the inspectors is their best shot at getting the sanctions eventually lifted.
Mm. And what are the other nations outside of the Security Council? Do they support this resolution at all?
I think every nation, now that it has been decided unanimously by the Council, will say that they are in agreement with it. In fact, we should not In fact, we should recognize that that agreement comes with a great deal of pressure. For example, one of the countries on the council, Mauritius, a very impoverished African country, recalled their ambassador 2 days ago because he was deemed insufficiently enthusiastic about supporting the U.S. proposal. It turns out that the U.S. aid to Mauritius includes a specific requirement that the aid recipient not do anything in contradiction to U.S. foreign policy interests. That's written into the law, into the aid agreement. So there was a great deal of fear in Mauritius that the insufficient enthusiasm of the ambassador at the United Nations might jeopardize U.S. aid. And, of course, there's a precedent for that. We saw it in 1990 when Yemen, after voting no against the use of force resolution, was told by an American diplomat that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. And 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen. That was what the people in Mauritius were afraid of.
He who pays the piper calls the tune.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. For several weeks, Kuwait has said that it was awaiting the resolution from the United Nations before it would allow U.S. troops to be stationed on its territory. We reached Tariq Al-Mazren, spokesman for the press office of the Kuwaiti embassy, earlier today. We asked him if Kuwait is now prepared to allow U.S. to use its bases for the U.S. to launch a war against the people of Iraq.
It's not in that matter, Verna. I mean, we support the UN resolution. America is our ally. America has liberated our country and led the coalition. And to be very important, something here. Our constitution banned Kuwait to attack any other country. Based in our constitution, our military, we can use it for defense purposes. This is for internal Kuwaiti matter. Based in America, America is our ally. We're going to work with the coalition. We're going to see what's good for the region and what we can do to ask. The poll here, it's not in Kuwait side. It's in the Iraqi regime side. If he wants to prevent war, if he wants to stop everybody talking about war, actually, he's the one who has to work on it. We are asking him, please. It's just basically if you're on resolution, comply with it. If you have nothing to hide, it comply with it. And let's relax the religion. Let's keep going in our life. Stop hijacking the region. Every 2 or 3 years, you provoked something. And, oh, let me go to the Arab streets. They will cover me. No, this has to stop.
Okay. Can you confirm reports that U.S. troops have been preparing for maneuvers in Kuwait near the Iraqi border?
Oh, yes, I can confirm that. But this is nothing unusual. We are doing this since 1991. Every 6 or 3 months, it's a schedule. It's not abnormal. It's part of our security arrangement. What they are doing basically there, they are trying to work with the Kuwaiti troops to enhance our capability in Kuwaiti army. Because if you remember during the invasion, Iraq almost looted all Kuwaiti military.
Tariq Al-Mazren, spokesperson from the Kuwaiti embassy here in Washington, will have more of our discussion with him, along with some who say the people of Kuwait do not support the government's line. President Bush says it's time for all patriotic Iraqis to embrace this resolution as an opportunity to escape war. And he reiterated that any Iraqi noncompliance would reap serious consequences. The resolution was just passed today by the Security Council, yet the Bush administration has been preparing for weeks to launch an attack against Saddam Hussein. 50,000 U.S. troops are amassing in the region, and 3 U.S. cargo ships carrying tankers have left the U.S. shores. That's according to Reuters news agency. Correspondent Jeremy Scahill is stationed in Baghdad covering the impending war with Iraq. Jeremy, the Bush administration has its resolution in hand and is preparing for war. Certainly the word has gotten to Baghdad. What's the mood like there?
Well, people are extremely on edge, particularly with these results from the U.S. election, the total clean sweep of the Republicans. I mean, this is a country that's been bombed by both Democrats and Republicans, so no one here is under any illusion that, Democrats are necessarily better than the Republicans. But what this indicates is that George W. Bush's agenda is going to be accelerated, is going to move forward. The United States essentially getting everything it wanted out of this Security Council resolution, with the exception of a few minor points that France, Russia, and China managed to get out of the resolution. But largely the situation is that I think people are very much heading toward a direction that says says that they need to prepare for war.
And how does that look? How is that manifesting?
Well, I was just down in the south of the country in Basra, and it's very, very different feeling on the ground in the south of the country than it is here in Baghdad. You do not see an open military presence in Baghdad whatsoever. But in the south of the country, on the main highway going north out of Basra, we saw many, many armed groups of people, both military and civilian. We saw what appeared to be armed civilian militia driving around on pickup trucks or gathered on the sides of the road. We also spoke with some Iraqis who are involved with disaster preparedness teams, and what they're doing is they're going out into communities and talking at unions, schools, and in villages, essentially preparing people for disaster. And in addition to that, you have teams being formed that are going to be responding directly to those disasters, and they've gotten as far as actually mapping out routes at where the different team members are going to be picked up in the event of a massive U.S. attack. And parallel to this, you do have reports of civil defense courses going on in parts of the country. Apparently, the different governorates of Iraq have been authorized to essentially map out a localized response mechanism to a U.S. attack or invasion.
Mm-hmm. Is there a presence of the American Red Cross there, or Doctors Without Borders?
Yeah, you do not have a tremendous number of NGOs that are operating in Iraq. In fact, it's quite a small handful of them. The International Red Cross is here, and they are working with the Red Crescent Society, the Iraqi Red Crescent Society, and the Red Cross itself is involved with some of these disaster preparedness trainings. There's a camp just 10-plus miles outside of Baghdad, but that was closed off to journalists. We were not allowed to go and see that. But privately, we have talked to people who are involved with this, and they shy away from saying that it's a direct result of the current threats, but it's very, very clear, Verna, that it is.
You have been speaking with the Iraqi people themselves. What are they saying about this impending war, Jeremy?
Well, many people here do not speak about war in the future tense. Their entire lives are about trying to survive war. The most unprecedented economic sanctions and ongoing bombings. But, on a personal level, one gets a sense that people are very much beaten into the ground by this U.S. policy. And also their own daily lives here. This is, no matter what anyone says, this is not a free country. This is not a country where people feel free to say what they think about the government or their state of life. People are very, very afraid and shy away from those questions. But, the fact is that that is what the media, the corporate media, have chosen to focus on in this, is Saddam Hussein as an individual, and in the process of doing that, making him represent 23 million Iraqis. The fact of the matter is that a majority of Iraqis have no power and no control over the U.S. government or their own government, and they are caught in the middle of a repressive government and an atrocious, horrific U.S. policy that targets them mercilessly every day.
Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy Scahill speaking with us from his hotel room in Baghdad. This drumbeat to war has triggered political responses from the creators of art and poetry among the peacemakers of the world. Professor Obadike Kamau is a co-host of Pacifica Station KPFT's Critical and Progressive Review, or CPR, in Houston, Texas. Dr. Kamau is a political scientist, but he also expresses himself through the genre of spoken word and through music. During an interview with KPFT programmer Akua Holt, he states his views on war and peace.
These are the ruminations of a cluttered mind. As in the sky, a falling shooting stars of thoughts zoom through my head, largely of their own accord, at their own speed and velocity. And I randomly pluck from the ether sphere, one from here, one from there.
Let's talk a little bit about your writing, because you're one of the few poets that I've known many years, and you've always written political responses to what's going on in our world, in our environment.
I really just think it's a natural orientation. I do love poems, and I do other kind, I guess a tree poem every once in a while. But what moves me, what sparks my spirit, is commenting on what's happening, what's impacting our lives, and how we can in turn impact that. This war, to my way of thinking, is an excuse to save illegitimate administration. And this administration has been able to complete, to convince enough people to vote for the continuance of this really insanity. And war is devastating. In this case, totally unnecessary. I'm anti-war.
These are the ruminations of a cluttered mind. Thoughts flung as spears, lodging deeply in their targets, planted far below the surface so that their roots are strong. Thoughts.
And we seek righteous vengeance, and we use all of our icons and religion to support this stance. Mm.
Well, we talked about war. Let's talk about peace some. In your mind, how can we encourage our country to embrace peace?
I of course, think that the way to encourage our country to embrace peace is through the sharing of information. We don't understand how our actions are impacting children and mothers and elders and men that are not soldiers. So I think that there is information that is not being shared with the American public, and we can disconnect ourselves from those people who our actions are having such a extreme deleterious effect on.
Wondering who is our neighbor, then realizing it doesn't matter because we don't love ourselves. Crying out selfishly, bless them, O God, for they know not what they do. Too nearsighted to see, let alone admit that we don't either.
If you had one thing to say to the Iraqi administration and the American administration, what would you say to them?
If I had one thing to say to the American administration, I would say that they really need to think about going into a sovereign nation and attempting to dictate the way those people live.
Then can we study war no more? Cause our sons won't have to go. And we can smugly speak of loving our neighbors as ourselves while performing surgical strikes with bombs and dropping turkey sandwiches from the skies.
If I were the Iraqi leadership, I would encourage them to get out of the military mode that they're in and to do some things for their people. Their people are in a very, very bad situation as far as poverty, as far as illiteracy, as far as lack of education. And I would try to convince them to remove themselves from the international arena with the posture that they presently have, and to turn inward and to try to improve the quality of life for Iraqi people.
Thank you very much, Dr. Obadike Kamau, spoken word artist, poet.
This is about loving our neighbors as ourselves and helplessly understanding that our neighbors don't stand a chance.
Dr. Obadike Kamau and his recent album, Babadoc, Ruminations of a Cluttered Mind. This segment was co-produced by KPFT producers Akua Holt and Renee Feltz. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll go to India, where we'll meet W-Man. Back in a minute.